Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 4, Various Topics. Watchman's Teaching Letter, Number 64, August 2003. From the 2003 Watchman's Teaching Letters, by Clifton Emhiser, read by Dan Adams. This is my 64th monthly teaching letter and continues my 6th year of publication. With the last letter, number 63, it might appear that I am straying off the subject of Daniel's prophecies. If that is the impression you came to, I would assure you that I have only diverged from that topic in order to once more address the ever more important subject of race. I found this reiteration on race necessary, as there is still a lot of confusion on this theme. You might also have gotten the impression from the last lesson that when I use the term Israelite, that I am excluding all the other descendants of Adam, which I am not. When the designation Israelite is used, there is a definite association with the pre-Abrahamic descendants of Adam. To show you this, I'll quote Deuteronomy 32:8 from the King James Version. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Therefore, if we don't understand how the Most High separated the sons of Adam, we cannot comprehend the entire thrust of Daniel's prophecies. Many ask the question, what about the descendants of Ham and Japheth? Inasmuch as I haven't gotten deeply into that subject in the past, I will attempt to address that one with this lesson. So with the help of one of my proofreaders, William Fink, we will tackle that issue. Because the following represents some of his notes to me on this subject, and because I did not entirely quote him word for word, but paraphrase him at places and insert some of my own remarks, with his permission, I will dispense with the usual quotations. Just keep in mind that this composition is the product of two people, some his, some mine. One thing that even identity pastors miss on Psalm 2, which I addressed in lesson number 63, and to understand that, one must comprehend the concept of the nation, that is, in Genesis 10. This is the fact that Israel is not the white race chosen by Yahweh in preference to non-white races. No, not at all in that sense. Rather, Israel is one branch, one family of the white race, chosen and preserved by Yahweh in preference to all the rest of the white race, Genesis 10 nations, which has since been destroyed by mixing, voluntary or not, with the other non-white races and the children of Cain. Except for the Arab, mixed multitude, peoples, and the children of Cain, which are all despised and dispersed, among whom are Moab, Esau, etc., the other races are not even on the biblical radar screen. You can see from this, then, that if any of the white descendants of Adam are excluded, it's because they didn't keep their racial purity. In light of everything, Psalm 2 may be interpreted thus. The heathen and peoples, with their kings in that passage, are the non-Israelite branches of the Adamic race. The anointed are the body of Christ, which is defined as the children of Israel, with Yahshua as their head, king, which Paul describes. Peter uses this passage to describe Christ Yahshua himself, Acts 4, where it could be said that although that may be one fulfillment, the general fulfillment of Psalm 2 was when Israel was warned against and decimated by other Adamic nations. So in this respect, Psalm 2 is like Genesis 3:15, applicable to both Yahshua himself and again to his people Israel. A study of history will reveal that the children of Israel as Greeks, Romans, Scythians, Saxons, etc., did gain dominion over or destroy all the other Adamic nations before those nations were overrun by non-white races. So we have a past fulfillment of this, and we'll get a future one, because all unmixed Adamites will be resurrected, as Yahshua testified, and ruled by him, with his administration chosen out of the children of Israel, the saints. Hence, the kings, all ye that judge the earth, serve Yahweh with fear in the Septuagint, and surely the other races cannot do that. So now we have a better understanding of Psalm 2 and who the nations are from the Old Testament, before Israel's dispersion, bringing us to a fuller perspective. People are easily deceived because many terms have been twisted and corrupted. For instance, if one wants to find the Old Testament prophecies concerning the Canaanite variety of quote-unquote Jews, he surely can't expect the prophecies concerning Judah to be applicable. Just because man confused the term, we can't expect Yahweh to do likewise. So one must read the prophecies concerning Esau and Canaan to learn their ultimate fate. The same is true of the other races. If one wants to know about black people or Mongolian people in the Old Testament, he must look up the phrases beast, where it applies, and beast of the field. It's that simple, as the blacks and Mongols aren't even on the biblical roadmap. As it may be demonstrated, Yahweh even has a sense of humor, as Psalm 2:4 suggests. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh, the Lord shall have them in derision. Now also see Isaiah 56:9, all ye beasts of the field come to devour, yea, all ye beasts in the forest. I explained Isaiah 56:1 through 8 in my brochure entitled The Lie of Universalism, Number 1. But I should have included verse 9. When verses 9 and 10 are included, we can see that Yahweh foresaw that the dumb watchmen, 56:10, would screw up the meaning of Isaiah 56:1 through 8 and allow the beast of the field, other races, to devour, mix with, the true children of Israel. We note here that the word devour, again, in this sense, is used in exactly the same sense in which one ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, etc. How much plainer could it be? The other races are not even thought of in the Bible, except in this context. Any identity minister who doesn't realize this is one of those dumb dogs. And if the shoe fits, wear it. Someone ought to have a very serious man-to-man talk with Arnold Murray of Shepherd's Chapel fame. You might be becoming aware that this subject correlates with our study on Daniel, as the Persians were our people, but were not under the Abrahamic covenant. Though the Persians were Elamites of Shem's line, they probably had a king of the tribe of Judah, as did all the empires of Daniel 2 and 7, possibly the Zerah branch. Many of the Genesis 10 peoples, descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, can be identified in ancient history and archaeology. Genesis 10 is a snapshot of the Adamic race sometime early in the period between the Genesis 11 event, Babel, and the call of Abraham. All of the Genesis 10 nations which we can identify were alive and well, in a secular sense, at the call of Abraham, but later fell into a state of universalism and multiculturalism. Possibly Yahweh sent Abraham to Canaan because a judgment was about to come to Mesopotamia and northern Syria, which may have been the land of Arphaxad at that time. Shortly after Abraham's departure, we have, which the Bible does not record, the destruction of the cities such as Mari, Ebla, Nuzi, and the takeover of northern Syria and part of Anatolia by the Hurrians. The Kenites and Hittites rose to power after this, from which Abraham may have been saved. While in Genesis 17 and other places, Abraham was promised that his offspring would become many nations, surely that has been fulfilled in today's white Israel nations. The nations of the earth which shall be blessed in Abraham, a promise going back to Genesis 18:18, speaks of the white Adamic nations of Abraham's time, those of Genesis 10. Yahweh gave all the Genesis 10 nations over to their own desires. They had all followed the ways of the heathen. It was for this reason that Israel was constantly warned not to follow such ways, and for this reason that, as outside the scope of the Bible, the entire Adamic world was being overrun, mongrelized, and destroyed. Yet preservation was continually promised to Israel, from who the white nations of today are derived, except the Slavs, who may be Japhethites, see Genesis 9:27, of which a connection of the Slavs can be made to the Medes in Diodorus Siculus. Whether or not this is good or bad depends upon whether they kept their racial purity. If for a fact this is true, we may still have a few scattered pure-blooded Japhethites among us today. So an entire old white world was destroyed, bastardized, a process which took over 2,000 years, and an entire new white world was created from the children of Israel, and probably some remnants of the other tribes, most surely, a process which also took over 2,000 years. And today, only one person in a million has any concept of this whatsoever. Well, maybe a handful in a million, but many in identity don't even realize the impact of this. In fact, with some of their bizarre, unreal, and twisted teachings, they are actually aiding and abetting the continuation of that bastardizing process. So, how were all of the old white nations blessed in Abraham's seed? Don't take this statement wrong, but Yahweh married only Israel, and Israelites have a special future among the children of Adam as kings and priests, priest-kings, or administrators. However, these administrators need something to administrate. Anyway, all Adamites have the spirit of Yahweh, and all Adamites will be in the resurrection, which Joshua clearly illustrates at Matthew 12:41-42, Luke 11:31-32, and which Job declares at Job 19:25-27, and Job 14:10-15, it being understood that Job was an Adamite, but evidently not an Israelite. Because from Abraham's seed the race was preserved and the redemption process fulfilled, the murder of Yahweh in the flesh by the children of the dragon, all Adamites were freed of the false accuser, Satan, the devil, and will be resurrected. The bigger picture is barely discussed because the focus is on the preserved nation Israel, and only Israel will marry the Lamb. Paul's mission to the nations, mistranslated as Gentiles in most Bibles, was surely directed toward Israel and those long-forgotten Israelite nations descended from Abraham. Yet at Athens, in Acts 17, the natives were actually, for the most part, Ionians, the children of Javan, the Japhethite, which is the reason for much of Paul's unusual discourse here. Most people do not realize that even in those late times, tribal divisions and differences in belief and custom distinguished most Greek cities. Paul understood that, although today's theologians do not. Without question, most, if not all, of the recipients of Paul's epistles and visits were to long-transplanted Israelites who happened to have among them communities, hence synagogues, of recently, at that time, migrated Judeans, some of whom were Judah and some were obviously not. Understanding the destination of the Genesis 10 nations allows one to appreciate so much greater the promise by Yahweh of the preservation of Israel, even seeing that a great number of Israel fell victim to destruction. Also Carthage, Greece, Italy, the Celts of Anatolia, etc., so that even we in this age may be considered but a remnant. With all of the troubles we endure now, surely we will yet be preserved to flourish again. It is hoped that this larger picture of the term nations, with the application for the Adamic race past and another for the Christian Israelite nations of this age, has been illuminated sufficiently here, and understood and found to be agreeable by all concerned and to whom it applies. As I stated previously, the greater part of this commentary is from another scholar. I will now continue with some thoughts of my own. We first have to consider that the earth was entirely bastardized, except for 8 people at the time of Noah. You might say, at that time, the white race was skating on mighty thin ice. Had there been any other unmixed white people at that time, they would have been on Noah's ark. When it says that Noah was perfect in his generation, Revised Standard Version, it meant he and his immediate family were racially pure. Shortly after the flood, Ham looked upon his father's nakedness, which was his mother, and his son Canaan, by that union, was a product of incest. Now, if that doesn't agree with your theology, maybe you better check Genesis 9:22, Leviticus 18:7, Leviticus 20:11, Deuteronomy 22:30, Deuteronomy 27:20, Ezekiel 22:10, 1 Corinthians 5:1, Amos 2:7, Genesis 35:22, Genesis 49:4, 1 Chronicles 5:1, and Samuel 16:22. Is that enough witnesses for you? I covered all that in my Watchman's Teaching Letter number 25, May 2000. As a result, Ham's son Canaan was cursed and kicked out of the family, only to mix with the serpent seed of Cain, which, by the way, folks, had survived the flood, which was designed only to wipe out God's creation, the Adamic race. Cain is not Canaan, and Canaan is not Cain, but their descendants eventually mixed together, acquiring a double curse. Eventually, Ham's name came to mean black, not because he wasn't white, but probably because his descendants mixed with the darker races. In the Bible, about 1500 BC, Egypt is called the land of Ham. The Egyptians are recorded to be the descendants of Mizraim, Genesis 10:6, 13, and 14. It might have a double meaning, inasmuch as the Nile Valley, about 5 miles either side, consists of very black soil. Yet again, it may be because some of the descendants of Ham settled there, or maybe both. Historically, we know that some of the descendants of Shem settled there, and that many of the pharaohs were Shemites, particularly the pharaoh that gave Joseph's wife, Exodus 11:7, gives us reason to believe that the general population might have indeed been the descendants of Ham, which read, "But against any of the children of Israel shall not a dog move his tongue, against man or beast, that ye may know how that Yahweh doth put a difference between the Egyptians and Israel." I would remind you what I wrote in the Watchman's Teaching Letter number 35 for March 2001, which I'll repeat here. Apartheid in Egypt for Israel. We are told by many the people of Egypt were the same white stock of people as the Israelites. This is not entirely true. This is why it was so necessary for the Israelites to settle in an area where the two peoples wouldn't mix. Even the standard Bible commentaries are aware of this. This from the Wycliffe Bible Commentary, page 43, commenting on Genesis 46:31-34. Before Joseph presented his family to Pharaoh, he gave them specific directions about how to reply to the ruler's questions. When asked about their calling, they were to represent themselves as shepherds. Then Pharaoh would likely assign them the land of Goshen as their dwelling place. Goshen would provide excellent grazing for their flocks and herds. They would be together and therefore well protected from mixing with other peoples. End quote. In the Believer's Bible Commentary by William MacDonald, page 79, we have further confirmation that this was indeed the reason for the Israelites settling in a place where they could be isolated to themselves. It was agreed that they would tell Pharaoh that they were shepherds. Since shepherds were despised by the Egyptians, Pharaoh would let them live in the land of Goshen, far away from the royal palace. There in Goshen, they were isolated from social intercourse with the Egyptians, first because of their nationality, Genesis 43:32, and then because of their occupation. God, Yahweh, left them in this incubator until they were a strong nation, able to possess the land that he promised to their forefathers. End quote. We also know that on one occasion, when the land of Canaan was having a drought, Abraham and Sarah went to Egypt for relief. Upon the Pharaoh desiring Sarah, he was plagued by Yahweh, whereupon he gave Abraham much wealth and some Egyptian maidservants. Hagar was one of them. Evidently, Hagar wasn't entirely white, as we are given witness at Galatians 4:29. But as then he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the Spirit, even so it is now. This passage can refer to none other than the hassle between Ishmael and Isaac, and the fact that Ishmael didn't have the Spirit is damning evidence that his seed was not pure through his mother. If true, again the white race was skating on mighty thin ice, for only one person stood between them, the kings and priests, and extinction. It should also be noted that Lot went along with Abraham on that occasion, and got himself an Egyptian wife, which might explain much concerning the Ammonites and Moabites. I have much documentation that some of the Ammonites are now the Japanese. Again, when Esau despised his birthright, which all race mixers do, only one, in the person of Jacob, stood between the white race of kings and priests and extinction. Are you getting the picture, or need I draw you another diagram? How tragic, then, that we would esteem our heritage to such a low degree. How calamitous that we would view our race of no value and go so far as to promote universalism.
If the seriousness of this matter of race was not understood before, it should be now. And if one is any kind of a man at all, he'll write or call each and every one of the anti-seedliners and universalist so-called ministers or teachers in identity and let them know he doesn't appreciate their dangerous position. And if the men don't do their job, the women will have to step in and do the men's job for them. After all you she-bear women, the enemy has intruded between you and your cubs. It's time to show your claws. As I wrote in one of my brochures, they're your children, do you really care? It is quite evident that the anti-seedliners and universalists among us don't care. All they care about is trying to gain some theological brownie points, and spurious points at that, and any time they want to leave the movement, we can thank God and Greyhound they're gone. More on the nations of Genesis 10, sons of Japheth. Gomer, Genesis 10:2. Gomer is difficult to document. Gomer's sons surely occupied what we call southern Russia today. To what extent the early sons of Gomer absorbed alien races cannot be estimated. However, the entire region was eventually overrun by Asiatics by the end of the first Christian millennium, 1000 A.D. On Genesis 10:3, of the sons of Gomer, the quote-unquote Jew, Kessler, in his book The 13th Tribe, written concerning the quote-unquote Jewish migration to Kazakhstan, lists tribes which he purportedly documents to be descended from Togorma, on page 72, which are Uyghur, Dursu, Avars, Huns, Basili, Tarniak, Khazars, Zagora, Bulgars, and Sabir. Ashkenaz, surely a component of the ancient Jewish, Turkish, Khazar trading empire, hence Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan now, supplies his name to what are otherwise called the Russian Ashkenazi, quote-unquote Jews today. Magog, Genesis 10:2, often pronounced Magog, from the prophets, can be discerned to have gone somewhere east into Asia, where exactly cannot be known. Mongolia and Tibet, home of the ancient mixed races with a clear Adamic cultural influence, may be conjectured. Javan, Genesis 10:2, and in the prophets often where we find Ionian Greeks. Surely, since they are called Yavanna by the Shemitic Persians, Ionians dwelt in a region of Asia Minor and also founded and inhabited Athens and its environs. Tarshish, Genesis 10:4. Herodotus wrote of Tartessus as a port city even before the time of the Trojan War, circa 1184 BC, early 12th century BC, surely corroborating King Solomon's shipping industry. Unfortunately, before the end of the first millennium AD, most Greek lands were overrun by Arabs, Mongols, and Turks. The last holdouts, Constantinople and Greece itself, were conquered by the Turks in the 14th and 15th centuries AD. Tiras, along with Javan's three sons to be treated in the next lesson. Meshech and Tubal, Genesis 10:2. These two we will treat together. Over 1,500 years before the Germanic Rus conquered the land which bears their name today, Ezekiel wrote of Rosh in the Septuagint or Rush, the authorized version, being the leader, prince of Magog, Meshech, and Tubal, Ezekiel 38. This is by no means coincidental. Whoever Magog may have been in prehistoric times, we can be certain that his descendants are found among those gigantic Gog mixed masses of Caucasian, Mongol, Chinese, whatever blood who are found inhabiting much of Russia today. In light of the relationship with the Rus were to have with Magog, Meshech, and Tubal, which Ezekiel 38 illustrates, Herodotus mentions two tribes among those under Persian domination, the Moshi and the Tiberni, Herodotus 394 and 778, in a convenient geographic region that without stretching the imagination, we may associate these ancient Japhethites with the dwellers around the Russian cities of Moscow and Tobolsk today. However, it is certain that at some point in time, all of the peoples have mingled with pre-Adamic races related to those of the Orient. Madai, Genesis 10:2. That Madai is identifiable with the Medes should be evident simply by checking both terms in Strong's Concordance. Herodotus 7:62 wrote that these Medes were anciently called by all people Arians, although it was more likely that the term Arian, spelt A-R-Y-A-N, was rather used by Israelites who once sojourned in Media. The Greeks had Israelites in Media confused with actual Medes. The sons of Ham, Cush, Genesis 10:6. There were two lands of Cush, the first known to the Greeks, and so to us, as Ethiopia appears everywhere in the Bible as the word from the Hebrew for Cush. Ethiopia in Africa, once white, as can be discerned from the meaning of the Greek word and from the Bible and Greek historians, was overrun by Nubians in the 8th century B.C., While that did not totally destroy the country during the Christian era, all of the white Cushite blood has been lost. The second Cush at one time may have been near Mesopotamia, where some of the Midianites dwelt in Exodus 2, Numbers 12, and extended east toward India. This is supported by Genesis 2:13 and the fact that there are Hindu Kush mountains in northern India today. Distinct from those of Africa, the Greek poets and historians Hesiod, Herodotus, Diodorus Siculus often mention the Ethiopians of the East and relate that Memnon, king of Ethiopians, built Susa, capital city of Persia. Abraham's children by Keturah, Midian among them, were sent off to the east, Genesis 25, 1-6. Surely, Hebrew and Greek historians coincide quite well. Of course, there are no white races left in this area today with which to identify these Kushites. However, northern India has a long, long history of Western influence.
Mizraim, Genesis 10:6. Mizraim is the Hebrew for Egypt everywhere in the Old Testament. At that time, Egypt was the Nile River Valley and the Delta, as far as Elephantine. To what extent the Mizraimites may have mixed with aboriginal populations before Joseph sojourned there cannot be estimated. However, the Egypt of Joseph was quite different and not dominated by Mizraim. Of the sons of Mizraim, the Anamim were named in an inscription and likely inhabited an area at or in the vicinity of latter-day Cyrene. The word Naphtuhim seems to be Egyptian for people of the Delta, Pathrusim for people of the southern land, Kaftor was a district in Egypt, and Philistim or Philistines left Egypt to settle in Palestine. The Ludim in Egypt are often mistaken by the translators for Lud, son of Shem. Put, Genesis 10:6, often the prophets associated with Libya, a name coming from an alien tribe. The Lubim, as did the early translators. Yet it can be demonstrated from early Greeks that civilized whites did inhabit the Mediterranean coasts of Africa and were not Phoenicians. An actual linkage of any of these people with the name Put is not yet detected. Canaan, Genesis 10:6. Canaan was cursed, and any discussion of him must be reserved for an investigation of the descendants of Cain via admixture, Genesis 15, 19-21. Of the sons of Cush, Sheba, Genesis 10:7. Sheba, as opposed to the Sheba of Joktan, Genesis 10:28, was a district near Ethiopia in Africa, see Strong's Numbers 76:14, and is often mentioned along with Dedan in the Prophets. Sheba and Seba are mentioned together at Psalm 72:10. Like Ethiopia, Egypt was also overrun and ruled for many years by Nubians, a black race, an event from which she never really recovered, in the 8th century B.C. And we still haven't learned our lesson, folks. Eventually, all the Hamites became mingled with the black races of Africa, which, along with the Arab incursions and the earlier Phoenician settlements, gives us today's Berbers, Moors, Ethiopians, and the continent's many other mixed races. The sons of Shem, Elam, Genesis 10:22. Everywhere we find Elam in the Bible, we read people later known as Persians in secular history, along with Madai, Genesis 10:4. Elam formed the Medo-Persian Empire of historic times. Much later, these two tribes, along with many of the Israelites deported to Babylon, formed the Parthian Empire. Iran, originally Ariana, a part of Parthia, was overrun first by Arabs and later by Mongols and Turks, creating the mixed race which resides there today. Ashur, Genesis 10:22, the Assyrians, who became a great empire, but mixed with the Hittites, Horites, Hurrians, and others at an early time. Although surely many pure Assyrians must have existed at the time of the prophet Jonah, see Jonah 3:8, who urged them to repent.
Assyria was destroyed along with its capital Nineveh about 625 BC by the Scythians, Israelites, and the Medes, Madai. Lud, Genesis 10:22, the Lydians of Asia Minor, only mentioned elsewhere by the prophet Isaiah at 66:19, an event fulfilled by the Israelite Celts. All other mentions of Lud or by error Lydians in the Old Testament are actually Ludim, sons of Egyptian Mizraim. Before the Etruscans were descended from the Lydians, as recorded by both Herodotus and Tacitus. Aram, Genesis 10:22. Everywhere the word Syria appears in the Bible, the Hebrew word is Aram. This word is also the root of Aramic, one of the languages of Palestine. Originally, Aram was centered in Damascus. The ancient Greeks spoke of Kinnerus, a Syrian who colonized Cyprus, although he may have been a Phoenician. Jacob took wives of Laban the Syrian, although he too was a descendant of one of Abraham's brothers. Eber, Genesis 10:24. From Eber we have the name Hebrews. Eber, Strong's number 5677, is the same as the word meaning across or opposite. Hence, we have Eber's name in many places on the opposite side of the Mediterranean from Palestine, the Iberian Peninsula, the Ebro River in Spain, Hibernia, which we now know today as Ireland, and Hebrides, islands off Scotland. Later, one of the first countries inhabited by the deported Israelites near the Caucasus Mountains was also called Iberia, and Diodorus Siculus mentions a Hebrus River in Illyria. Of course, the Israelites descended from Eber. Joktan, Genesis 10:26-29. Only a few of Joktan's sons will be mentioned here briefly. Sheba was an ancient kingdom in what we now know as Yemen. Ophir must have been on the east coast of Africa. It is the source of the name Africa, the original Latin being Afer. Jobab, meaning Father Job, may very well be the Job of our book. Summary thus far on Genesis 10, on what we have presented. More to come in later lessons. This record in Genesis 10 is more or less a snapshot of our race as it was originally dispersed after those events which are represented by the Tower of Babel story recorded in Genesis 11. There are at least 1,500 years between this dispersion and the time of Moses, the author of our record. Surely many of these people spread out further, mingled with others, or moved entirely during these 1,500 years. However, at the time of Moses, there are no Europeans other than the few Japhethite settlers of the Mediterranean coast. It can be shown that all of the northern and western Europeans, as well as many of those original eastern and southern Europeans, were actually the children of Israel. For this, one must realize the origins of the Phoenicians, the Danans, the Dardans, and Dorians, and Latins, and then the Scythians and Celts. These must, of course, all be discussed individually. With all of the formerly white Adamic nations except those left of Israel being completely overrun and destroyed by the other races, and today being among the poorest and lowest backward third world countries, you would think that Israel would learn from this. You would think that finally we would see the importance of being a separate people. Exodus 19:5, 33:16, Deuteronomy 14:12, 26:18, Titus 2:14, and 1 Peter 2:9-10. Of course, we haven't, because we are ignorant of history. This is only the beginning of volumes that could be written on this subject, which I will continue. This represents only a nucleus, which could be expanded into a great study by those interested in preserving our origins. But instead, the white race is swiftly going to hell in a handbasket. And who really cares? Surely not the anti-seedliners or universalists. This should now give you some idea of who is Adam and who is not, and who is Israel and who is not. Also, it should be very clear that the table of nations in Genesis 10 concerns itself only with the sons of Noah and they were all white, at least at that time. It would be well, then, to cite the prophecy which states the fact that what was happening immediately prior to Noah's flood would happen again in the end days. It is found at Matthew 24:37-38. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark. While much of the prophecy of Matthew 24 has already happened, this passage we are seeing fulfilled before our very eyes. The marrying and giving in marriage mentioned in these two verses was the miscegenation between angel kind and Adam kind, that which produced mutated giants. Today we are witnessing a similar condition. I recently heard that 90% of young people now look with favor on race mixing. That should give one some idea just where we are on Yahweh's time clock. Note, this summary on the Genesis 10 nations are from notes by William Fink. I will continue using his notes in the next lesson when going into a little more detail on this subject. End of Watchman's Teaching Letter number 64. Thank you for listening.